Foundation at kresge.org.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
Oops, sorry. And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View, if I can get my headset on.
That's necessary.
Oh, yes. It was tied up around my face somehow. Anyway, we want to welcome you to the show this morning and hope you'll stay with us. You know, it's in some important issues that we'll be discussing, and you'll want to stay tuned then for Radioactivity for more important issues. But this morning we'll be talking about cybersecurity. Listening to Senator Nelson's warning, we need to take action to beware and to protect our voting. We will begin with Democracy in Chains, especially an attempt to eliminate the right for you and me to elect our senators.
Well, you're talking about the 17th Amendment.
Yes, that's the 17th Amendment, but a lot of people don't know what the 17th Amendment is. I sure didn't until this all started to happen. And support for WMNF comes from our members and WEDU-PBS. WEDU will honor nonprofit organizations and volunteers during the WEDU Be More Awards. Applications and nominations will be accepted beginning August 30th. Information is online at wedu.org/bemore.
I'm really excited about this show. I'm just in very few minutes, we're going to be getting in touch with Dr. Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains. And so when so commonly, you know, we're watching what's happening and our jaws are just dropping open because we can't believe this is the president and we can't believe this is what these people are all doing. And you commonly hear the refrain, why isn't Congress doing anything? What is Congress doing? Well, I think that you need to put together Democracy in Chains and Nancy McLean work and then put Jane Mayers there, and you have an idea why Congress isn't working too much to help us out here. And then, yeah, cybersecurity, again, to me, we should have been in cybersecurity. Well, some people will say 20 years ago, but certainly we should have been big time understanding it, us as American people. No, we don't want all of the details because we understand that intelligence is involved. And we also are beginning to understand that cybersecurity, cyber threats, cyber attacks, whatever you want to call it, is happening daily. I was talking last week to David Sanger, and I said, it's happening daily. He said, no, it's happening almost by the minute. And so we're kind of the last as the American public to know. And but Sarah Granger is going to try and clue us in about some of the aspects on voting. So as I say, I am really excited about this show. And so I'm going to put some music on because I don't want to delay it a minute. And then we will get in touch with Dr. Nancy McLean and go from there. And again, you're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Oh, indeed. Which side are you on? And I am so excited, because if you want to know what side you're on, I think you have to learn a lot about really what status we are in. And I am so happy to welcome back to the show Dr. Nancy McLean. And she is the author of Democracy and Change, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. She's actually a prize-winning, award-winning author of other books, Beyond the Mask, Behind the Mask of Chivalry, excuse me, and that was a New York Times noteworthy book, and then Freedom is Not Enough, which the Chicago Tribune, Contemporary History at its Best. She is a William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke, and she lives in North Carolina. So, Dr. Nancy McLean, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Mary.
Oh, well, your book, to me, I was just saying before I got in contact with you that if we really kind of wonder, because we're seeing everything that's happening, and people are really going to ask, why isn't Congress doing anything? Where is Congress?
Yeah.
Well, I think if they read your book, they might understand where Congress is or where it is not.
Thank you. I do believe that's true. Yeah, we have to understand what's happened to the Republican Party, what the Koch donor network has affected, how shrewd the strategy is, and how much the Koch network is working with the Trump administration, and in fact dominates the Trump administration, if we want to understand what's happening now.
Yeah, and I heard you, and I can't remember what we were being interviewed, and they were talking, because Koch has said he's very opposed to the tariffs with Trump, and they give this fluffle, that there really are oppositions. Uh-huh. But frankly, as you say so well, Dr. McLean, that Trump wouldn't be in the office if, frankly, not for the Koch brothers and all their 30-plus years of preparation, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really telling. Listeners could pause and think about that. All the things that the Trump administration has done, the constant strategic use of race baiting, the breaking with European allies, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, all of these other things. The only thing they seem to be able to object to is the tariffs. That tells you a great deal right there. But as my book explains, Donald Trump really is, in a sense, the strange fruit of this very, very long, decades-long, in fact, attempt by a particular school of thought that most people don't know about, Virginia Political Economy, it's called, to discredit government and to make citizens distrustful of government, of democracy, and essentially to advance this billionaire agenda that is highly unpopular. And the only way that they have learned that they can do that is by not being honest about what it is they're actually seeking. And what they're actually seeking is a world without Social Security, a world without Medicare, a world without any form of social insurance, with no minimum wages, all of these things that would affect our daily lives in such dramatic ways. Now, no one's going to vote for those if they know that's where this is going. So instead, these very sophisticated operatives, and there are literally hundreds of organizations now funded by the Koch donor network, very sophisticated operatives do all kinds of things to essentially throw sand in the eyes of the people and distract us, essentially, from this radical right plan that they have been advancing quite aggressively, particularly since 2011, after the 2010 midterms. But under the Trump administration, they have surged ahead in their accomplishments. And Charles Koch actually said at one of the most recent donor summits, "We have accomplished more in the last 5 years than I was able to accomplish in the previous 50. So they are quite content that their program is moving along. And while we're all distracted by Donald Trump and his outrageous conduct, understandably, people pay attention to that, they are moving their plans along in federal department after federal department, agency after agency, in the 30 states they now control, and increasingly through our federal courts and the Supreme Court as well."
Well, I really want to get on to the courts and the Supreme Court and the dangers of Brett Kavanaugh, but, I was able to go back and reread your book, and you had a little more time to do it. And, just this amazing summary you was just given. To tell you the truth, the thing that really was shocking me, and even though I've read it before, it really kind of hit home, that to me, the worst thing about this ideology, if you will, is the utter disdain for people,
yeah,
that they do not see the American American people. There are no American people. We are just individuals who happen to live in America. And so they not only, you know, they're not just like Norcroft and, you know, no taxes and they put it to a bathtub and drain it out. Mm-hmm. They want government, but they only want government that is very strong with military and police. But they are very opposed to the whole sense of democracy because it challenges their sense of liberty.
Yeah, it's real. I mean, I have to say, I just felt like I was entering an alternate universe as I worked on the research for this book over a decade, and it really took me a long time to almost believe that I was seeing what I was seeing before my eyes, because it is such a radical right ideology, and it's frankly at odds with the best of every major religious tradition in the world, too, in that kind of radical individualism you're talking about, in that sense that, you know, we don't owe one another anything, you know, it's a world where compassion doesn't matter, in a world in which we'd be prevented from, you know, helping one another through the use of our democratic government. So it is really quite something. And they actually, in their literature, refer to the majority of the American citizenry, the rest of us, as parasites, right?
Yeah, we're the takers.
They use language of parasites and predators, that other citizens are somehow preying on the people of extreme wealth who don't want to, be part of our democracy, right, who don't want to be accountable to it. And they refer to, for example, senior citizens, the AARP members, parasites. You know, we're talking about grandma and grandpa being referred to as parasites on the public purse. You know, parents of children with disabilities, right, through the Disabilities Act, parasites. You know, teachers who are trying to decrease class size so they can better serve students in places that are being so devastated by the opioid epidemic, predators on the wealthy. I mean, people really, really need to understand who these people really are, what they're about, if we're going to deal with the crisis in our public life effectively.
Yeah, and you know, it was really shocking again when I was reading your book, and that actually there are more people involved in all these subgroups, if you will.
Yes.
This network, this almost web, you might say.
Yeah.
That is the deep web. I often wondered, I thought, you know, I understand, you know, if you're paid very well and you're encouraged, et cetera, and every step of the way you get backing and you go along, so to speak, your path is more or less laid out. And I kind of wonder if they really actually have actually read Buchanan. Have they really?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, so this figure that I write about, whose story I just happened on by kind of accident when I was studying the state of Virginia's leadership of the wider white South in resisting the Brown versus Board of Education school desegregation decision in the 1950s. That's how I stumbled on this thinker, James Buchanan, whose ideas have been weaponized by the Koch network. But what I learned in researching this is that they don't advertise Buchanan, right? They don't advertise his ideas or put them out there, particularly in all these programs that they are developing for young people. And they are, you know, these Koch network organizations are funding just slews of internships and all kinds of programs in order to recruit young people into their programs, also trying to get teachers involved through their campus implants in the states and stuff. But they don't talk to them about Buchanan. They talk to them about, you know, maybe Friedrich Hayek or Ayn Rand or, you know, other people who will talk, you know, put out these bromides about liberty and so forth and, you know, the great virtues of the market. But Buchanan, I learned, is really like the advanced course for the people who are going to become hardcore operatives. And actually, there's a guy at my own institution, a Koch grantee, who runs they call it Buchanan Camp in the summer for these grantees. So Buchanan is the advanced course for people who are really serious about breaking the power of what they see as the other side, what they see as the enemy, which is the rest of us, things like teachers' unions, the AARP, civil rights groups, Planned Parenthood, etc., breaking the power of the enemy and re-rigging the rules of how our society and government operate in order to make it impossible for democratic majorities to achieve their shared vision of the common good. And the ultimate rules change that they're aiming at is altering the U.S. Constitution in a constitutional convention And it sounds crazy. It has actually never been done before since our Constitution was ratified. But it is one of the options specified in Article 5 of the Constitution. And while we have all been distracted by Donald Trump and his daily tweets and his antics, the Koch Network, through groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council that works with the state governments they control, has been quietly racking up authorizations to convene a state-led constitutional convention, and they now have 28 of the 34 states needed to authorize a constitutional convention to change our Constitution. And nobody, not, I shouldn't say nobody, some people like Common Cause, you know, there are some folks that are paying attention to this, but by and large, it is a story that's not being covered, and it is one we need to pay attention to, because if they get that constitutional convention, they have 10, what they call, liberty amendments, queued up and ready to go that would undermine all of the popular achievements of the 20th century, including Social Security, Medicare, anti-discrimination legislation, you know, our efforts to have clean air and water, et cetera. It is really radical.
Well, it is so radical. And I'm even thinking of Clarence Thomas, because I really want to spend a little time on the courts and the judges, because to me, this is really a huge part of the ballgame. But I'm going to go back just a minute, because really, I think to me, because when I kept reading this book, I kept thinking of this, and I thought, this is really extraordinary, you know, because when you think about government, you know, a lot of it is kind of a social contract, if you will, that isn't really all written. It's not just dependent on the Constitution, but it's our attitudes to each other, respect, et cetera, caring about your neighbor, all of that kind of stuff. And so it's kind of a give and take, you know, that we elect representatives, and we expect those representatives to reflect our views. Yes, they can be somewhat independent, too, but the point is, if they want to say, put a road in or a dam in or something, or, you know, that if the medical costs are too high, they, in other words, schools. In other words, it's been kind of a loose amalgamation, if you will, of people's wishes being reflected in a democratic process. And, you know, we've developed, you know, a pretty sophisticated system, if you will. And to me, it is absolutely shocking that if even Clarence Thomas says, well, you know, that you can't destroy all the institutions or you will not have anything left. And it is that radical. And I think, wow. And so when Koch, with all of his billions, and obviously the kind of problems that he would have that you want to have, because whether they want to say it or not, this is almost messianic complexes.
Oh, it is absolutely a messianic complex on the part of Charles Koch,
Yeah, but when you come across a Buchanan, and, you know, they're going back to Brown versus Board of Education in Virginia, very sophisticated Virginia, the heart of this country, if you will. That's where so many of the writers of the Constitution came from. Brown versus Board of Education. Oh, you know, you cannot impose that. And it just kept going from there.
Yeah.
And here we are now, where there we've got a president that perhaps has broken the law. And we've got constitutional crisis, you know, boing, boing, boing from every area. And there we've got a Senate that's trying to push a nominee that wants to give an imperial presidency. You know, you think.
Yeah, I think this Brett Kavanaugh nomination is extremely dangerous. And I really hope that people are paying attention to it, because Brett Kavanaugh is actually kind of, you could say, the hand-selected choice of the Koch Network through Donald McGahn, who is the White House counsel, who presided over this process in collaboration with the Federalist Society, which was started with seed money from Charles Koch years ago, and a man named Leonard Leggio, who worked with the Kochs, you know, vetted all these candidates. I mean, the Koch investment in changing our legal system and our Constitution is the great untold story of our time. You know, we've had terrific work on the dark money that they're spending in electoral politics, above all Jane Mayer's wonderful work, Dark Money, and many others. And, of course, you know, they're talking about more than that. But the piece that hasn't been paid as much attention to, and I think needs attention, I tried to do it in my book, is their deep, deep and highly strategic attempts to change the legal system, to change essentially the rules of the road, right, in our society, of how we deal with one another, how corporations are allowed to deal with us, and how we run our society. And they have already effected quite radical changes that I describe in the book, but the ultimate one would be this constitutional convention. And I believe that if they are able to seat Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court in a seat that, frankly, you know, they stole a seat from President Obama, if they seat Brett Kavanaugh, Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is the kind of justice who would bless whatever comes out of this constitutional convention. And, you know, I think at this point, you know, we have a president who was able to illegitimately appoint Neil Gorsuch from a, you know, to a seat that they stole in a, mm-hmm. in a historically unprecedented power grab from President Obama. And I think we just have to draw the line here and say this presidency is already too compromised, right? They have that stolen Gorsuch seat, but as a society facing these radical changes, these unprecedented developments, it's time for us to take a deep breath and slow down. There is no reason to rush this confirmation. We need to know exactly who this person is, exactly what his record is, and exactly what's gone on with this presidency before they are allowed to stack the Supreme Court and decide the rules of generations to come in America.
Yeah, and I'm particularly worried about the legal system because quite obviously an awful lot of people that have a very different view, the takers and the makers, so to speak, that, yeah. you know, with Brown versus Board of Education, civil rights, women's rights, et cetera, and then GBLT rights, that it's just totally gotten out of hand. And so they really got furious at the courts and, quotes, these activist courts that were, you know, undoing the will of the people, yet they want a court, number one, you know, that's given a citizen's United, and also has given us Roberts, that Roberts has really already, challenging the Commerce Clause, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg really responded to that. She was shocked about the regressive, you know, political attitude mm-hmm. that was. And so, but could you real briefly, because I want to spend a lot of time on that, the training, in other words, they don't just, you know, come from above, they come from below. And the kind of training and the kind of law professors and George Mason mm-hmm. University, right yeah. across the Potomac, all of that has really been astonishing to the degree yeah. that, what, 40% of all of our judges right now in this country have gone through some of their training?
Well, that was in the mid-1990s. Now, since then, Obama has been able to make some appointments, so, you know, the numbers wouldn't be quite the same. But, by the time Charles Koch got really serious about this messianic plan of changing our country and began to invest in this intellectual base camp at George Mason University, which is a public university, ironically, just over the Potomac from Washington, D.C., in 1997, by that point, two-thirds of all federal justices had gone through this law and economics training, essentially being treated to a Koch-backed curriculum by the dean of George Mason's law school at that point, a man named Henry Manny, as I describe in the book. So it's really quite something. But yes, Koch has invested in several of these legal organizations, most prominently the Federalist Society, but also the Institute for Justice, a number of others that are not insignificant. You know, several of them have brought cases to the Supreme Court and won. The mm-hmm. Federalist Society, of course, now vets all Republican candidates for the judiciary. So they really have kind of a chokehold over the judiciary, you could say, at this point. And what I learned in my research is that this is a highly, highly strategic long game. That has been going on under the radar for years and years, as you say, particularly with these investments in select economics departments and law schools, some political science departments. But basically, they have tried to create what they have referred to as the hardcore libertarian cadre. They actually use the language from Lenin of the Bolshevik
right.
Revolution. And Charles Koch, as I described, was introduced to Lenin's work by someone he funded in the 1970s and saw, hey, this is a great idea to develop this cadre of people and create what Buchanan called a gravy train for the care and feeding of that cadre, who would then go out into all of these organizations and institutions and into the academy in these donor-funded positions like they have at George Mason. And it is really, really quite something what they've wrought. Now, I know we're going to probably have to break soon, so I don't want to leave your listeners in a situation of kind of catatonic horror. So let me say what I believe to be the most important single finding of my research, and that is that this Koch network and the operatives it funds are doing what they're doing in the way that they're doing it by stealth, because they understand from repeated historical experience that the vast majority of the people, including those whose votes they depend on, do not want the kind of society they want to bring into being. And they are deadly afraid that if the people start to understand what this is and where it's coming from, they will stop it. And that is why they have tried to operate under the radar. That is why they've tried to operate by stealth. So the single most important thing that we can do is alert as many people as possible to this effort, help them to understand its dynamics. Once you understand the strategy, you can anticipate their next moves, you can block their moves, and around the country, I've been traveling, speaking in communities across America over the last year, people are, you know, understanding that this is happening, realizing that this is an all-hands-on-deck moment for the defense of democracy, and getting into action. So we shouldn't panic. The last thing we need is panic and craziness and, you know, stuff like that, but we do need people to very carefully and deliberately inform all the people in the networks and organizations they belong to about what is happening and help get active in organizations. And there are many, 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 many good organizations out there working to stop this thing. And I do believe that we can stop it, but I also believe that to stop it, we are going to have to deal with some of the chronic problems that have developed in our democracy, including money in politics, you know, the corruption, the lack of representativeness, the gerrymandering, all those kinds of things, voter suppression, all of those things are getting in the way now. But I think if enough people are alerted and become active, we can deal with these things and we can renew democracy for a new century ahead of us, really.
Oh, well spoken, Dr. Nancy McLean. And we need sunshine. We need information. And luckily, Democracy and Change, the Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America, and Jane Mayer's writings, and many others. We can't summarize it any better than that. And so thank you so much. Arlene needs to say something. Go ahead, Arlene.
I just wanted to say that it's available in both hardcover, paperback, and ebook form.
And you've been so generous with your time today. Thank you so much. And keep up the good battle.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's always great to talk with you.
Well, it's wonderful talking to you. You do take care.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. Oh, that is so generous of her, because I know how busy she is, full professor, you know, at Duke, et cetera, but wow. And the book is amazing. It's a really good read, and it's shocking to me. It's really shocking to me that we, the American people, don't exist. You know, we are just people that live in this country. That we're so dangerous to liberty, and that it kind of turns the world upside down. But after you deal with it a while, and you see, and you understand when they say, "Where is Congress?" Well, too many people in Congress are put there by this money and these beliefs.
And as John Gilmore responded on our Facebook page, he said, "Are we headed for a day when, on a date certain, we tally candidates' bank accounts and the one with the most money wins?"
Well, I don't know. I think the Russians would get involved with that, and we might end up with Putin as our president. They'd bring in all the bitcoins and all the other things. We better be careful with that one.
We need to be careful with that, and you need to stay tuned for Radioactivity after this show, because Rob is going to be talking more with a guest about the Russian connection.
Oh, we can't talk too much about it. And so I was able to catch up with Sarah Granger yesterday, and so I'm just I think I will go right into this. I'm sorry, but she's got an awful lot to say, and if Rob's going to continue on it, it's really, this is important, people. So anyway, Sarah Granger, let me put her on and we shall proceed. I am so happy to welcome to the show Sarah Granger, and she is quite an internet blogger extraordinaire. She actually has been involved for over 20 years with various writings, etc., San Francisco Chronicle, Spectrum, Huffington Post, Forbes, Harvard Business Review. She's also been an expert on NBC, NPR, Good Morning America. She wrote a book, The Digital Mystique. And so, Sarah, I'm in sad need of your expertise right now. So welcome so much to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know that I feel that with all the worries and concerns about cybersecurity, that actually you would really know that I think we should have been openly discussing this, really, certainly since the Obama administration and back in the Bush administration, because here we find now, like right down here in Florida, Senator Nelson has charged that the Russians have hacked into many of our county voting systems and that they're running free. And Scott has said either put up or shut up. And so then some experts have said that Senator Nelson's right. Some others have said, no, there is no immediate sense of hacking by the Russians. And so here all the rest of us stand, including the poor administrators of the various counties and votes can really have the expertise to handle this. And so here we stand, and this has kind of been 20 years in the making, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Actually, probably longer than that, ever since people first started thinking about putting election systems online, from just the spreadsheets that could be edited all the way up through now they're talking about internet voting. So we've got a full range of issues now.
Well, and, you know, I think it's pretty clear that the Russians did hack in 2016. And then also I've been following it this year, and Claire McCaskill, they announced that they tried to hack into her system. There were there were serious charges, actually, that in, I'm never sure, totally sure, your California man, Rohrabacher, that there have been some charges, that there was some definite Russian hacking in to try and defeat his primary opponent. And so I find that here we are, to me, most of us in the dark about cybersecurity, and we hear Trump say, well, you know, it could be the Russians, it could be the Chinese and North Koreans, whoever, or, you know, a 400-pound genius somewhere. But the intelligence agencies really have a little more expertise than that, don't they?
Yes, they do. And a lot of these systems, there's actually been proof. There was an annual DEF CON conference recently, which is a bunch of hackers get together in Las Vegas, and there were 12-year-olds hacking into voting machines within minutes. So this is something that is actually pretty widespread at this point.
Well, you know, I don't know if you followed it, but when Jill Stein challenged the vote in Wisconsin, and I thought that actually some of the testimony, because the judge did allow some testimony by various experts, and I was pretty horrified. I was following some of it, and this one professor, I believe, at MIT said, well, he said, we start out elementary in our classes here, you know, then to hack into the voting machine. And so, yeah, and there you've got 12-year-olds. But you know, in terms of hacking, so to speak, there are so many ways, at least that I can see, that they could interfere with an election. And it doesn't have to necessarily mean affecting the vote content, but voter registration, you know, just a slight error here or there, and that person goes to vote and they say, oh, you're not properly registered. To me, I see this as just a grave threat, really, to our whole democratic processes.
Well, it is, and I would think in Florida it would be something of extra concern after what happened in 2000. There's still plenty of us who have not forgotten that. So.
Well, we haven't either, and it's going to be a close election. And, you know, the charges are really, really serious. They're going back and forth. And, you know, Nelson, in his position, he's on the subcommittee with the Armed Services Committee in the Senate of cybersecurity. And Sarah, you would know so much more than I do, that the more I'm reading about this and learning about this, whether it's SUSNET or some of the other hacks and then rehacks by other people, that this kind of stuff has been going on, as you say, for over 20 years, and we don't know about it. And so, to me, there's almost a low-grade war, if you will. I don't know what to call it, you know, when sabotage, when is it just, you know, being nasty, et cetera. Or to me it should be a pretty serious offense if you are hacking at all into our election systems. But, you know, I don't feel that the administrations, either Bush or Obama's administration, and now the Trump administration, have been straightforward to us at all.
Well, it's a difficult topic because so much of it happens at the state level, and all of these election system decisions typically take place between state governments and the vendors of these machines. And so in California, we had a very sharp Secretary of State who early on identified that there were problems with these electronic voting machines. And she said, you know, we're going to go off these systems. We're going to make sure that we always have a paper trail for everything. And it's been a lot better here for that. But there are still plenty of states that are employing these machines that have known security bugs for years. And those are just the voting machines. That's not the actual machines that we vote on are separate from the registration records, which I know is part of the big issue there in Florida with, when you that's a separate system for who can register for voting. So, and usually that's more of a database that's statewide or countywide. So a lot of this stuff is decentralized. So it's very difficult to track what's going on and to know how many of these systems have potentially been compromised.
Yeah, and I'm particularly concerned about voter registration because particularly ever since the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Parkland shootings, you know, these students, and not just those students, but students all over the state have really been going out, you know, doing rallies, et cetera, and they've been making efforts to particularly register younger voters. And I've gone to some of them in our areas, and I have seen them with their clipboards, et cetera, and many people are signing up. And yet I just saw in the paper only a couple weeks ago that actually they're very disappointed because they thought with the Parkland shootings that there would be this increase, and they said there really hasn't been that increase. And so I'm not saying that that was somehow hacked into, but would it be possible, something like a voter registration rolls, could you do something to nullify some of those registrations?
Absolutely. If the system has any access to anyone who could possibly tamper with it, whether it's through the internet or somebody who is somehow paid under the table and works for the, you know, county, they could go in and alter these records. If it's on electronic media and it's not, it doesn't have some sort of fail-safe system like extra backups and paper trail that is constantly rechecked, then there's always the possibility that this could happen.
Well, and again, I'm going to go back to the testimony in Wisconsin, and I was pretty horrified when I was reading some of the testimonies, and they were saying that that there are so many ways that actually one could alter things, you know, everything from coming in, a person could come in and just insert this stuff, and it would screw the rest. But I was also concerned that actually, the reporting of the ballots and the vote count is pretty much different at each precinct, so to speak. And that actually, so many of them, they essentially use cell phones. Or, in other words, if you could hack into a cell phone, you could easily alter that vote. And I thought, is it that easy? And so I guess I've been wondering, has there been kind of hacking, if you will, or perhaps alteration of some actually vote, elections, results, whatever? And frankly, ever since 2002, when Bush ordered, you know, the modernization, and these two private companies who were very Republican and said they would do anything to get Republicans and, you know, elected, could we be having a low-scale kind of alteration of an awful lot of elections ever since then in various ways?
Yes, it is possible. It is definitely possible. And I certainly, you know, when we first received the results in 2016, it seemed so off from the polls. It was difficult not to speculate about low level, you know, minor changes at the counties, just enough to shift the vote. And it wouldn't take a lot of effort. They would have to be coordinated, of course, but it could certainly happen because there are only a certain amount of counties and states that are really in play when you talk about an election like that. But, you know, when it's a statewide election, you've got even less votes you have to worry about changing, and less counties. And you also have to put it in perspective with the overall picture. It's not just the electronic efforts that are going on. It's all of the other efforts to close down certain precincts or keep people from registering, requiring IDs, all of these things that are happening in different states to suppress registration. It's very frustrating when you look at the big picture and step back. But, you know, my focus obviously has been more on the electronic side of things, but certainly when you put it all together, it does show that there are plenty of ways that elections could be meddled with. And this is not new. You know, we've always had concerns with our election integrity. It's just become more complicated over the years.
Yeah, and in 2016, I can't remember the name of the company actually that it actually does the voting machines for all of Florida and for most of the Southeast, and they were definitely hacked into. And then from everything I have been reading, that it's not just a matter that a country or an individual that had bad feelings, et cetera, could hack in, but they, you know, and could just gather and look around at data, but that they actually can implant malware. And they, in other words, it isn't just a matter anymore that it's just snooping. That actually they can put this malware in and an implant. And then they can do all kinds of things. And, you know, that I guess when Barack Obama was so aware, because actually, as I understand it, the Chinese hacked into some of his systems in the 2008 election. And so it's not like they haven't been aware for quite a while that this is a problem. And so when they had the kind of evidence they did in 2016, do you think President Obama handled that well? And if he didn't, why do you think that he was so afraid to almost the last minute to make this announcement?
Yeah, I can't speculate on that. I really don't know what was going on within the administration, but it was definitely frustrating to see, you know, as somebody who had been really watching the election closely, that there wasn't a little more attention given to the election integrity. But again, I think that it goes back to the states, and if there was any effort that should have been done more directly, I would say that it would have been more outreach to the states and potentially some sort of incentive program to use more secure systems, to have a paper trail. I would love to see a law that said that we need to have voter verifiable paper audit trails, because a lot of states still don't have that. And, you know, as you said, it really doesn't take very many votes to change this. And so a lot of this malware that goes in and all it does is just tweak a few votes so that it's not obvious. If they tweak too many, then it would raise flags in the system that there was some sort of problem. In some of these, they're not all set up that way, but it, you know, there are definitely cases where they have thrown out some votes because machines have showed unrealistic data. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that can be identified. So you have to be really careful about this, but yeah, I don't know why at the national level it hasn't been given more attention. I definitely think that it should. There are organizations out there like Verified Voting. They do great work, and they have been advocating for this for years, and trying to educate policymakers at all levels about the importance. And I think that only in the past few years has anyone at that level really understood the extent of the damage that can happen. And now, as expected, we're dealing with it as a last minute scenario, and it's really too late for most counties to change their systems at this point.
Well, and from everything, and again, we're talking to Sarah Granger, and as you can tell, she is a computer cyber whiz. She's written a book, the Cyber Mystique, that which I've decided I've got to read. But you know, Sarah, to me, it goes way beyond Trump. But we do have the problem that Trump is so worried that, you know, if there's any credence given to this hacking and the ability to affect the outcome of an election, that he thinks that it will, you know, cast a shadow on his election. But I think what really set me off that I had to learn more about cybersecurity, when I read actually last year that actually the Russians, you know, have been hacking all over, and this, that there's just daily, in fact, almost hourly battles going on, and that they had hacked and, so to speak, warned us that they were into our nuclear power plants. And that they could, you know, shut it off. That's all you have to do is shut off a valve, say, in the cooling towers. And to me, I was utterly alarmed. And I thought, whoa, what is this? And any reading I have done is that with Barack Obama, and that actually this is the first, so to speak, weapon, if you want to call cybersecurity a weapon, and I think it would have to almost be called that, that has actually been developed by the intelligence communities. And apparently there's some friction between the more conventional military and the intelligence and who does what to whom. But, you know, after what happened with Stuxnet, that I think that really you really have to bring the American people more up to speed on what has been happening and what is happening.
I agree. It's definitely been a more prevalent problem, and we've known about the weaknesses in these systems, like the power grid and any power plants, over the years. Some of them have been dealt with, some of them have not been dealt with. Any time that a system like that gets online and is connected to the internet, it becomes more vulnerable. And that's certainly been an area that I've spent a lot of time talking with people in government about and expressing concerns, and I'm glad to see that they're more aware of this now, but the Russians, the Chinese, they've definitely been in our networks. They're also in our corporate networks, stealing corporate data and intellectual property secrets. It's pretty rampant at this point. You know, some people call it cyber war. You can call it information warfare. There are different terms for it, but at this point, we're definitely in a what was the science fiction scenario is now reality. And so we have to put some resources toward dealing with it. And I think a lot of the time, these government agencies and companies don't want to spend the money, spend the time until they've been hacked. And, you know, that's been my experience when I worked in network security. That was pretty much always the case. And so you have to really change the attitudes within these organizations so that they're more proactive in dealing with these problems before they result in catastrophic events.
Yeah, that, you know, that I didn't realize, you know, we think of North Korea as being kind of primitive and, you know, economically really very, very backward, et cetera. But I did not realize that they obviously are really up to speed when it comes to cyber snooping or cyber warfare, for whatever you want to call it. And I was just stunned when I was following some reading about, you know, that North Korea, that perhaps we were doing some hanky-panky to cause so many of their missiles to fail, and the North Koreans then went a totally different system. And then we saw what they did with Sony Pictures, and whether it's Sony Pictures or banks or the system in Saudi Arabia with their gas supply, etc., or right back here where I'm concerned right now, and I know many of us as Floridians, because, you know, we as state and precinct, you know, county elections, we don't have unlimited, you know, funds, and we certainly don't have the kind of, you know, cyber experts to even know really what to look for and what to do. And so, to me, elections and the sanctity of elections should be a national priority, if you will, or part of a national defense. I mean, you know, I think we have to expand this definition of defense here. What should we do, and what can we be looking for just as citizens?
Well, the first thing that we should pay attention to is making sure that we're registered to vote. And so there are ways to check online and contact county elections offices to verify that we're registered. So that's the first thing we can do as citizens and voters. The next thing is to advocate for paper trails and to make sure that these systems that are hackable are not in use in our counties and our state level. And then, you know, at the national level, I agree with you. I think absolutely we need to make election integrity more of an issue and raise the party. And I think that also we've got the campaign finance issues too, and that's another problem that hasn't been really dealt with. For some reason, I feel like every president steps away from this because they don't want to think that it might impact them in the elections, and they think that it's Congress's job to deal with. But it would be nice to see some stronger leadership in the executive branch as well as the legislative to deal with this.
And then particularly with one like a Senator Nelson, I mean, there are obviously people that have very high security clearances, and they can't discuss their sources. And to me, that's the worst kind of situation for all of us. Well, I can't reveal my sources, and probably he cannot, but it leaves us particularly in the dark. And so again, to me, I just think there has to be a lot more transparency. And I guess we need people like you to talk about it and educate us, because it doesn't seem to be coming from our politicians.
Well, a lot of the people who do have the clearances can't talk about these things. My clearance has long gone, so I have the freedom to be able to talk about it. There's nothing that I know that's remotely current. But I know a lot of people that I work with who have current information who cannot speak on the record about these topics because of government regulations and restrictions on them for their roles, and for really valid reasons, because mm-hmm. these are national security issues. And if you say that if you release your source, then it can cause problems for people working in the field gathering the data. It can cause problems for future investigations. And so there's certainly valid reason for keeping that information under control as much as possible. But you can generally make the assumption that most of this is coming from the intelligence agencies, and they know they're getting reports from different places in the country, and then they're looking into it and assessing how severe the problems are, and then they make the reports, and those go up the chain and get released to the members in Congress in these committees. It gets sent to people in the White House, and so they're well aware of what's going on. They just can't share the specifics.
Well, Sarah Granger, you have been so generous with your time, and we've gone through this pretty quickly. And so tell me, is there anything that you would like to mention? I'm certainly no expert in this field. And so is there anything you particularly think we need to know?
I would just say keep abreast of the news, keep following what's going on, make sure you're registered to vote, double check with the county, and then, if you have the time, Verified Voting has a lot of good resources. And so it's Verified Voting, making sure.
Sarah,
verifiedvoting.org.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you so much. I really do appreciate your giving us this time today.
Thank you.
You take care. And Sarah Granger. So, tried to give you some sunshine. To me, that's what you need, information, sunshine. It's there, and we've got a democracy to save, and I totally believe we can. Arlene?
And we had a Facebook, or not, an email message from one of our listeners. In fact, this is from Gina, who's a 20-year-old listener, and she said, I just attended the Black Hat DEF CON Cybersecurity Conference in Vegas a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
It was at that convention where they have hacking games to see if systems are penetrable. There was a young girl that successfully attempted to hack into the Florida's voting system. Ooh. It was just a replica system, not as robust as the real thing. The story leaked and spawned this most recent frenzy. The point of these hacking conventions is think bad so you can do good. As in, find holes so they can be fixed. She didn't actually get into the real system. And she said that convention was amazing in that with over 30,000 attendees, there was never a line in the women's bathrooms. It felt good.
I wonder how many of those were women.
That's the kind of...
No, that, we have technology, and it's fabulous. But, you know, in fact, that's one of the fascinating things, reading books in cybersecurity, that how many of us, President Obama, President Clinton, et cetera, they really saw the internet as opening to freedom and democracy, et cetera. And Putin and some others see it very differently. And so that, which is just fabulous, is open to be used in all kinds of nefarious ways because we are a strange brand of people. Go ahead.
And I remind you again that if you stay tuned for Radioactivity, you will hear more about the Russian activity on that show. And there are WMNF news stories that are of interest coming up today. Take action to oppose what women's rights groups are calling a, quote, fake women's health center, unquote, in Pinellas. And tomorrow, there will be a preview of Sunday's Women's Equality Day service in St. Petersburg. And you can check that out. I know there are events both in St. Petersburg and in Clearwater.
And you've been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Keep it here tuned all day, people.
Stole a few elections, still we the people won. We voted out corruption, big corporations.